Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You are tuned into an extra special episode of Real College Podcast Quarantine Edition, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. In this extra special episode, we have, after months of careful deliberation, decided to open the doors of the RCP vault wide for all to hear. In this episode of Radio K's Real College Podcast, we're bringing you discussions of the role of women in the armed forces, a bio on one of the stellar staff members over at the J School, the tale of how one man became the owner of his very own thrift store, a look at what scary experiences Minnesotans are willing to share, a chat with a Gopher athlete before the world went up in flames, and a look at what makes a cult a cult. You won't want to miss this. Be sure to stick around. In 1948, women were first allowed to serve in permanent roles in all the branches of the U.S. military, although not in quote-unquote active combat roles. In this first piece from the Quarantine Vault, reporter Luke Diamond explores the role of the draft in U.S. military history and what it would mean for women to be included in this part of the military system. Here is Luke with more.
On July 20th, Secretary of War Baker pulled a number from a goldfish bowl and the great draft lottery was on. For more than 14.
In 1917, the United States drafted 2.8 million men to fight in World War I. 23 years later.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii by air. President Roosevelt has just announced.
10 million more were drafted to fight in World War II. The last time the draft was activated was in 1969 for the Vietnam War. The Selective Service has been stagnant since then, but still receives $25 million a year in funding.
Honestly, $25 million really isn't that much.
That's U.S. Army recruiter Sergeant David Lowell.
When you figure it's responsible for maintaining databases for every male in the United States under, you know, the age of, you know, 50, above the age of 17, producing, you know, the website, maintaining their database, putting out, you know, informational flyers, and the staffing and manning for that's probably pretty large. From a governmental standpoint, $25 million is kind of a drop in the bucket.
So that's what it takes for the draft to continue simmering beneath our civilian lives. But what would it take for it to combust?
A pretty extreme event would have to happen. It would have to be one of the major world powers, Russia, China, India, as unlikely as that might be, maybe like a collective combatant that comes out of Africa somewhere.
In a lot of ways, being drafted today wouldn't be so different from the process of being drafted 50 years ago.
Everybody had to register.
That's Tom Insko, a Vietnam War veteran. Just like Tom did in 1969, every young man in the United States today has to register with the Selective Service after his 18th birthday. Then,
a live report on tonight's picking of the birthdays for the draft.
There would be a draft lottery in which every young man would be randomly assigned a draft number based on their birthday.
March 7, 1-2-2.
The lower your number, the more likely it was that you'd be drafted.
My lottery number based on my birthday would have been 12.
If you get a low number like 12, and then the government calls all young men with numbers, say, 1 through 50?
You get a notification in the mail. They send you and said, you've been selected. You know, Uncle Sam requires your presence to be inducted into the military service.
After you're drafted, you report to a military entrance processing station to be tested for fitness. These stations exist today in almost every major U.S. city.
And you had to go through a physical and some testing to see if you were fit.
If you're not fit for combat or conscientiously object, you'll either receive a deferment or be placed in a non-combat position. But if you are fit, it's off to boot camp.
You kind of cross the divide. You know, now you're in the military.
So a lot about the drafting process would stay the same. But what would change? The question at the top of that list, which I put to Sergeant Lowell, is,
do you think women should be drafted?
That was an answer I received from a lot of people. The question of whether women should be drafted is a controversial one, and it hasn't received an official answer yet. Sergeant Lowell's response was, let's just say, circumspect.
Women in combat, women in the military is a whole nother set of issues and philosophical, you know, complications. I personally feel that having women in a combat role, direct combat, can pose some complicating situations that I still don't think are necessarily good for a combat unit. But that being said, I don't feel that there's any reason that a woman should be prevented from being able to fulfill her service in the role that she sees fit and she's capable of doing.
Regardless of draftee's sex, Sergeant Lowell isn't thrilled by the idea of unmotivated young people being forced to serve in the military.
If you've got a platoon of people, you got 200 people under you, and maybe 10% of them want to be there, and you got 90% of them bitching and moaning and complaining and going, oh man, this is the worst thing ever. How do you motivate those soldiers to put their life on the line? How do you make them take an objective when it's risky, when it's not something that they're particularly motivated or bought into? So for me, I would hands down take one motivated person over 10 people that don't want to be here.
But that doesn't mean that Sergeant Lowell doesn't support the draft. To him, the draft isn't a matter of good or bad. It's a matter of when it's necessary.
Nobody wants to go to the ER to get stitches. Right. But should stitches be allowed? Absolutely. You know, does the draft need to be an option? 100%. Is it something that I ever look forward to having to deal with? God, no. Above and beyond that, I feel that having some sort of.
For me, anyway, it was an individual story, you know, not a group story.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it was happening. What happened to me happened to me. And I didn't necessarily think, well, I'm part of some group that was unlucky and it's happening to all of us. You know, I was living my own individual life and I was just doing the best I could with the circumstances that were in front of me.
No matter what major or department, the U of M is chock full of all-star caliber professors and staff. In this segment from the RCP Vault, reporter Bob Santos took the opportunity to celebrate one of the amazing staff members at the Hubbard School of Journalism. Here is Babs with more.
Christine Molin has been the Student Services Coordinator in the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication for 5 years. But she's been around the University of Minnesota for much longer than that.
I actually went to the U of M here for my undergrad. I went a while ago.
What year was that you finished your undergrad studies?
2009. I did cultural studies. CSCL is the department. And then I left to do AmeriCorps for a little while after graduating.
AmeriCorps is a program similar to the Peace Corps, but here in the States. Workers live on a stipend during a year-long commitment where they're placed in an organization. Christine's assignment was to teach communities that had been without access to technology.
Like, I was teaching people how to use, like, a computer mouse who've never used a computer before. So it was weird to think of, like, someone who, you know, to break down, like, using something that I use every single day to, like, a very minute little thing and try to get them from that point to be able to, like, find jobs and apply for jobs online.
After AmeriCorps, she returned to the U to complete a master's degree while working for the School of Pharmacy.
In pharmacy, they're all professional graduate students, like medical students almost. So they all already have their bachelor's degree, and now they're working in the health profession. And then now I work with undergrads, so it's like a very different group of people.
Molin appears to have found her calling working for the J School. The undergraduate students are typically younger, so sometimes they expect Molin to be a lot of things, including an academic counselor, administrative assistant, a sympathetic ear, and sometimes even a sort of den mother.
When students are really undecided and they're like, what do you think is the best option? You know, and they're trying to decide between something like elementary education and journalism, and it's like a totally personal choice, but I'm like, I don't get to weigh in on that. That's like, you have to make that choice. Otherwise, they're pretty straightforward questions. They all want to know, can they graduate on time? Can they study abroad? Can, you know, are they going to be able to get into the major?
Even after students are accepted into the school, Molin says the questions keep on coming.
For the big chunk of the semester, I just meet with students a lot, answer email questions. I organize all this, or coordinate all the student groups, so like getting them set up for the semester. So it's really, really busy at the beginning, and now we're kind of getting into like, we've done admissions, we're waiting for registration to start, so there's like a little bit of lull.
But even when things quiet down in the office, it's not for too long.
Yeah, so other than typing, it's pretty quiet. Students don't often like call, but the phone might ring. But the door opening, there's like our door is just really heavy, so I hear that all day, every day. It's the door opening. When we have admissions and like lots of people are dropping off applications, we have to just keep the door open because it's just so disruptive. So
the door isn't the only thing that's been disruptive in the world of journalism recently.
I think also with the election, it's been an interesting time to just be in this department. This journalism's not my background, but it's been interesting because, you know, all our faculty, you know, a lot of them are journalists or were reporters, and so they're, you know, watching them react to things. So I remember people were like, we should teach ethics more, you know, and just like how what's happening, you know, politically makes people want to update and maintain the curriculum. You know, it's kind of interesting place to be just in time. So it's really cool to watch, you know, like strategic communication students are doing, you know, a whole different skill set, but like for journalism students, like reading admissions essays or seeing like why they want to become journalists, and you know, it's like kind of a profession that's under attack a little bit. So it's, you know, it's kind of cool to see that students, like you can see they're super committed to that. But yeah, also journalists are super important. So it's kind of like an interesting and really cool department to be in right now.
The university has adapted the way that it teaches journalism in response to recent changes in the media landscape. I asked Christine if she felt the school needs to start teaching any new classes.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And that's cool because I sit on the undergrad committee. I'm the note taker. And like this, I think this is probably the class you're in right now. Podcasting is a new class.
Do you listen to any podcasts?
Just one right now for fun. It's like a true crime podcast. It's My Favorite Murder.
So. My Favorite Murder?
Yes. Oh. Yeah.
From Ragstock to Goodwill, thrift stores are a major part of college fashion and culture, as cash is usually in short supply, and new clothes after the, accident from last weekend at whatever rager one attended is absolutely mandatory. In this profile from the RCP Vault, reporter Megan Germanson has words with the owner of a local thrift locale. Here's Megan with more.
Hello, this is Kevin.
Hi, this is Megan. I'm outside.
Oh, is the door locked?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, gosh. Be down in a sec.
All right, sounds good.
Bye.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Megan. It's nice to meet you.
Yeah.
So, what is this building?
This is the old Hams Brewery. But, yeah, so this room's a mess, but welcome to my world.
I'm Kevin Looney, and I own Go Vintage, and I sell vintage clothing.
I met up with Kevin in the parking lot of the old Hams Brewery, now a warehouse, where his vintage store, Go Vintage, is located.
If I found a moth in here, it was out in the hallway, so I'm like, oh, wait, what was that? Oh, that was just dust. See, now I got myself all paranoid. The moths are the devil in my business. A little thing can kill you. I have customers that have had their whole collections decimated. So I've always been interested in vintage and used to go into Ragstack back in the 70s and 80s and come out with armloads of 50s jackets for, you know, $2 or whatever.
Despite always being a lover of vintage, he didn't actually start selling it until one day driving down Smith Avenue in the early 2000s.
And I saw a little teeny vintage shop that had a sign out that said, wanted bowling shirts, Western shirts, Hawaiian shirts. I bought a few shirts really cheap, so I sold them and went back and I bought more.
So he called up a friend who worked at an old warehouse. He started turning a profit, and at one point the owner of the warehouse needed it all emptied out.
So I filled my garage with about 4,000 bowling shirts, bowling shoes, novelty bowling items, and all from the 1960s and older. And so I started, then I decided I'd take my collection of vintage clothing and do a show.
Kevin started selling at vintage shows across the country and eventually made enough money to open up his own shop.
And I decided about 6 months later I was just going to open a shop. So I did it with no business plan or anything. I just winged it. And then 2006, I opened up Go Vintage on Selby. You know? So that was kind of where it all started.
About 5 years ago, Kevin got his big break in the industry when he met Daniel Orlandi, a costume designer for an HBO series, at the Manhattan Vintage Show.
Manhattan Vintage Show, and you'd meet the costume designers for different TV shows. I met Daniel Orlandi, who was a costume designer for Boardwalk Empire. Kind of had come across the a really good score 1 year of all deadstock 1920s menswear, and it all ended up on Boardwalk. And that was kind of the first big show local and traveling theater groups would buy from me, but he was the first one who came in and bought a lot of stuff for their pilot. Really nice guy.
Since breaking into the industry with Boardwalk Empire, Kevin is styled for the likes of Larry David.
Like, oh my God, that's Larry David. And I walked up to him and I said, "Hey Larry, what are you doing here?" And he was in sweatpants and t-shirt and he made fun of my name. Cause,
Kramer from, you know, Seinfeld.
Kramer, he loves vintage, so he was always at that show.
A Martin Scorsese film.
It's called The Irishman. It's about, I think it's out or coming out soon. It's with De Niro, Pacino. So it's kind of interesting when they send you Mr. Pacino's measurements, and you're like, oh my God, that guy's got a big guy. No,
I'm curious, what are Mr. Pacino's measurements?
I don't know, but I'm not going to disclose, but it was like, wow, that's kind of shocking.
And others he can't quite freely talk about.
It's probably a piece that I'll be sending off to a Netflix film that I signed a non-disclosure for, but I don't know why, because it's already out there, but I'm not going to break the agreement I signed and tell you what it is. But
we don't need any lawsuits.
No.
His storage room and shop are covered with piles and racks of clothing.
Vaudeville costume, of like a fortune teller costume, and very colorful silk. And this is also 1920. This is probably my favorite dress. I paid a lot for that dress. More, I wouldn't even want to tell you what I paid for that dress because my wife would shoot me. No, I'm just no, she don't care. But I just love it because it's a
he has his favorite
great
pieces.
Condition. It's black velvet. With
but he won't tell you how he got any of it.
Picking berries off a palm tree, which is pretty amazing.
How do you make your find? You say going online and all that, but like, what do you look for? How do you know what is worth pursuing?
I can't tell you all my secrets. There's so much competition, and I know people that go out and drive down the dirt roads and look for abandoned farms and break into these old houses, but to me, I can't do that. It's not mine. I don't own it, but I don't feel right about just going into an old abandoned place.
What do you think it is about clothing? What makes it so special?
You gotta be out hitting the streets and looking online and driving into the middle of nowhere and a moment's notice, and sometimes I'll just drive and go into the small little towns, but I'll ask around at little shops and stuff if anyone knows where there's old clothing, and sometimes it pays off. Sometimes you come home with two hats and you're like, oh man, this was an expensive trip. But it's kind of the thrill. The find is funner than the sell, you know. I always look in the pockets because you never know what you find.
Throughout our lives, we all unfortunately experience true terror at least once or twice. This is one of the overwhelmingly emotional experiences we all have in common that undoubtedly makes us human. In this quick audio postcard from The Vault, reporter Courtney Parker asks fellow Minnesotans what has scared them in the past. Here's Courtney with more.
What is the scariest thing that's happened in your life?
Dealing with my husband's lymphoma.
Oh, almost getting lost in Nickelodeon Universe. I found my little sister, so I followed her.
Well, just going back and forth to work is scary every day.
Oh, that's a long story. The first time I failed, I think is one of the scariest things because you feel like you can always do something, and falling is something you never really like, you know, something that's always got to be bad for everyone, but first time I failed was the scariest thing that ever happened to me.
When I found out that my dad had cancer.
I think I was about 10 years old. I fell off of a horse. It was scary because he was a big horse.
Long before the talk of face masks, toilet paper shortages, and Zoom's dominance over the U.S. educational system, reporter Emma Bublitz sat down to have a chat with a Gopher athlete about her life and how she balances athletics with her education. Here to bring us back to a simpler time is Emma with more.
So this semester, I have practice every day from 8 to 11, and I have lifting 4 to 5 on Wednesdays and Fridays, and I have an additional hour hitting on Thursdays, and then we have practice Saturdays for 3 hours, either 9 to 12 or 10 to 1.
Cammie is a senior at the University of Minnesota studying industrial and systems engineering. This is also her fourth year on the women's tennis team, although not necessarily in that order.
I've been playing tennis since I was 4 or 5, and everyone in my family plays tennis, so for me, when I was little, like, tennis was just something that we did, so I always grew up with it around the house. Playing college tennis was really just something I wanted to pursue, and I'm happy I'm able to play for such a tough program like a Big Ten school and Power Five conference.
When asked about why Cammie likes tennis, she said,
I just really like tennis because I like the mental side of it and how you always have to be thinking on the court, and there's also just an athletic skill that you need in order to reach a certain level.
Most students planning to play a collegiate sport commit to a school their junior year of high school. However, Cammie had other things to consider besides just her sport.
I waited longer because I didn't want to commit to a school until I knew I was into an engineering program. So I committed here October, November of my senior year in high school.
Tennis, check. Engineering, check. The University of Minnesota was the only school that filled both needs for her, although she may have compromised a bit on the school end.
I was interested in other schools where the academics were more rigorous, but I decided to go here because those programs didn't have as rigorous of a tennis program. I didn't want to play tennis if I wasn't going to be challenged in it, so this was the only school that challenged me athletically and academically.
Besides the tennis team, she doesn't love the school all that much.
Do you think you'd still be here at the U if you weren't playing tennis?
If I wasn't on the tennis team, I think it'd be very easy to just get lost in the swarm of people. We're like a second family. So it's like a home away from home.
As with most families, they spend a lot of time together.
We are 9 girls who see each other at least 20 hours a week just on a tennis court. So outside of that, with the time we spend eating and just hanging out, it's probably closer to like 40 or 50 hours a week.
The family seems to enjoy all the time they spend together, even though the members all come from different backgrounds.
Tennis, I think, is one of the most international sports in college athletics. So we have a girl from Uruguay, a girl from Turkey, a girl from Canada, another girl from Canada, a girl from the Bahamas, and then it's me, a girl from Minnesota, and a girl from Florida.
How do these girls balance tennis with their academics? The coaches understand that practice comes second to their schooling, which Cammie is grateful for given her challenging major.
Luckily, my coaches are pretty flexible with my annoying class schedule, so they work our practice times around my class schedule so that each person can pretty much pursue a major that they want to do.
Athletes at the University of Minnesota receive other help than just their coaches. They also have access to prepared meals Monday through Friday, along with academic tutors and advisors. Cammie says these go a long way in athletes' busy lives.
Really just get a lot of individualized attention just to make sure that we have everything we need to succeed both on the court and off the court.
However, some non-athlete students have expressed concern about the athlete's seemingly unhealthy amount of spirit wear and professor's leniency of test dates and assignments. Cammie wants to set the record straight.
It's actually a lot more difficult than what people see. I feel like it's one of those things that they could live a day in the life or even a week in the life of an athlete, they would realize that we don't try and take the easy way out. We're not dumb jocks. Like, we have a lot going on.
There are many different sports at the University of Minnesota that have different balls, rules, and practice schedules. However, Cammie thinks all athletes share the same interests.
Do you know anyone else on the other sports teams here at the U? Do you know anything about their experiences?
I would say most of us would agree that we love the sport that we play, whether it is tennis or a different sport. And like at times, yeah, it can be pretty stressful and pretty hectic, but we wouldn't be doing it if we didn't love it.
So Cammie said that she spends 40 hours a week as a student athlete. There is about 4 weeks in a month, 9 months in an academic year, and this is her fourth year. That equates to about 5,760 hours for her collegiate career, not including practice times in the summer. Tennis is part of her identity.
What do you think your life would be like if you weren't playing tennis?
That's a great question, and I've thought about that a lot since I only have 1 year left. I'm not really sure. Ever since I can remember, I've always been playing tennis. I feel like if I didn't play tennis, I would still probably be pretty active just because I enjoy it. But I also feel like I would kind of go a little nuts just because I would have so much time on my hands that I'm not used to having.
Cammie is trying to prepare for a life outside of tennis.
I should probably get it figured out soon because I'm not going to be playing tennis in a year.
So you're not going to be a professional tennis player?
No. No, I am not.
Were all those hours spent playing collegiate tennis worth it? Cammie would probably say yes. But one thing is for sure, life without tennis is going to be a big adjustment for her.
Before we end this special edition episode of RCP, we will hear from reporter Megan Germanson one more time. This time, Megan takes a dive into what makes a cult a cult.
One of the very strong pressures in a seeker's life is the social consciousness. What will people think? What will people say? And this is that very, very strong force that the negative power uses to keep people in line, to keep them trapped in religions that they have outgrown years ago, because people do not have the spiritual strength to take a step out from the crowd. If someone is ready for ACK, they'll be an ACK-N-CAR.
At ACK-N-CAR's global headquarters, I met with Benny Callahan, their communications director.
Yeah, my name's Benny Callahan. I'm from Australia. I moved over here to work for ACK-N-CAR, actually.
So. Inside the Golden Temple, Benny led me down a marble-floored staircase to a circular room with an indoor fountain and multiple portraits of ACK-N-CAR's spiritual guide.
So ACK-N-CAR doesn't actually, we don't actually publish our membership numbers. We don't judge success by the amount of people that we have. And so as soon as you start getting into the numbers thing, it's like, it starts to detract from the real purpose, if you like. Yeah.
But at some point, like, you have to maintain the physical space that you have here and the jobs and that.
Well, one of the spiritual laws is the law of economy. As I understand it, even this temple, we didn't take a loan. We built it based on the voluntary donations. We won't grow or build another building until the living ACK master says, you know, this is a priority. And yeah.
ACK-N-CAR is only partly open to the public. They have beginner classes and videos of their spiritual master on YouTube, but any details beyond that are reserved for members who have pledged as initiates.
We have what's known as the ACK initiations. It's an interesting thing to try and explain because it's really something that can only be experienced in a way. We begin as first initiates, and we move up through various stages or initiations, first, second.
Initiations are kind of like spiritual progress markers.
Basically, each initiation corresponds with a various plane of awareness, like the astral plane.
Although the spiritual guidance is only available to initiates who progress through and pay for the higher levels of awareness.
It's just a phase of learning. And so each plane of awareness or level of the God worlds contains within it vast realities of experience to be had in different realms. And yeah. I probably can't really talk about it much beyond that. But most importantly, there's far more to life than what we see with the physical eye, you know, and the inner realities are very powerful if we can learn how to work with them. I can't explain that. I don't know how it works from a scientific point of view, but it is true reality, and many, many, many people experience that, you know, so I can't really talk about it beyond that.
I know, I understand that a lot of it is sort of personal and individualized, so I can understand why that could be difficult to describe. Beyond that, though, I'm just getting a sense that there's a level that you don't really want to share with the public.
Yeah, I think there is an element of that. I mean, even among ACK members, we never talk about our initiation experiences with each other, ever. It's just, there's a spiritual principle called the law of silence, and I don't know if you may have come across it. You might have come across the vibration of it, if, in the sense of like there are certain sacred experiences for the individual that should just remain.
Before Paul Twitchell created ACK-N-CAR, he worked for the Church of Scientology, although Twitchell never admitted to any connection with other religious organizations.
So there is a lot, if you look at the ACK teachings, that we share in common with Buddhism, Hinduism, and Christianity, but we recognize the golden thread of truth. Sometimes what happened to truth was it would become embedded within a cultural practice. So in certain countries, you know, karma and reincarnation would become loaded down with cultural practices. And so the living Ek Master of the day, their role is to hold together these scattered truths.
As for those scattered truths, many of the Ek teachings have been taken verbatim from various Hindu texts. In online support blogs, former Ekists were surprised to learn that the Ek teachings were available through other religions with no strings attached. Several claim the religion used fear tactics to hold on to initiates, and many referred to Ekinkar as a cult.
Just to answer it directly, I mean, it's laughable. You know, we are the furthest thing from a cult you could ever come across. That's how what I would say to it, and that's how Ekinkar would respond.
There are definitely some questionable aspects to Ekinkar, like some of their spiritual laws, the plagiarized teachings, and the claims of former Ekists. But do these things make Ekinkar a cult? And what even is a cult? I reached the religious scholar Matthew Schmalz over the phone to try and get some answers.
Hello?
Ekinkar's law of silence seems particularly troubling, and Schmalz said there are two ways to think about it.
One way is that this is to control the flow of information and, you know, kind of PR strategy. And the other way, it's a way to preserve doctrines and practices, and it's only people who are well equipped to use them who should be allowed to hear the organization's secrets.
In general, according to Schmalz, religious cults aren't necessarily bad. But when a group that's guided by a charismatic leader becomes detached from society, any sort of toxic group dynamic can magnify.
Now, charismatic leader is sort of a neutral title.
Think Jim Jones, the Pope, and the Ek Master.
Their claim to authority is based upon a particular call or understanding of a divine call that, by the sheer force of their personality, breaks through conventional social norms.
But what does he think about Ekinkar?
Yeah, they're quite the group. Before you called, I was checking out the website. And, you know, their spiritual master is a guy called Sri Harold Klemp, I think it is. And so I think it is a real issue. It's appropriating all this stuff from Hinduism. To what extent is it acceptable to draw something from another religious tradition? And I think owning up to that would be something important for the movement to do.
I told Schmalz about Ekinkar's close affiliation with Scientology and asked if he saw any similarities between the two.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of religious beliefs, I'd say both movements are really, really centered on a kind of self-transformation that makes a person, you know, more successful within society, particularly the use of money and the way in which money is charged for particular kinds of spiritual instructions, which I think has cause for concern and has led some people in both groups to say that they've been ripped off. When you look at Ekinkar, you know, clearly there is a debate to be had about what's unhealthy religion and what's healthy religion, but you need to have that debate. I mean, the question is first, you know, what do people find meaningful? And two, what kind of assumptions am I resting my evaluation of the movement upon?
Schmalz wouldn't say whether or not he considers Ekinkar a cult. Maybe any hesitations toward Ekinkar are just a reflection of our own religious and societal biases. And maybe Sri Harold is right. And this skepticism is simply a result of giving in to the negative powers of social consciousness. But it does seem like there's a big difference between a religion founded on ancient texts and a religion founded on a vision to capitalize off those texts. Why is it that these new religious movements are even labeled as religions when their identities are something more akin to that of a corporation?
That's all for this special edition episode of RCP. Stay safe, Minnesota. We hope you stay happy, healthy, and connected. Signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.
Three nights at the motel under streetlights in the city of palms. Call me what you want when you want if you want. And you can call me names if you call me up.